This is Storytime, brought to you by Mary Washington College and this radio station. Hello, boys and girls. It's me, Aunt Peter Moonbeam, back to take you again this week to Storyland. This week, we're going to visit a girl named Linda, and she has a mystery story for us. It's supposed to be very good, so all of you climb on your stars as quickly as you can. Is everybody here? Good. All right, everybody on. Close your eyes real tight. Think of what a sky looks like when it's filled with stars. Go on. Now wish. Wish real hard, and we, away we go.
Boys and girls, are you ready for this week's story? As far back as he could remember, Ray Rand had loved the woods, and about the time he was 10 years old, he had decided to spend his life in them. This determination did not waver as time advanced, but from his earliest dreams, it was a being of a hermit or a trapper. He had turned to an earnest, wholehearted desire to enter the forestry service, not as a second-rate man, but as a college graduate with an M.F., that's a Master of Forestry degree, after his name. It takes money to go to college, especially to a high-class forestry college, and there was very, very little money in the Rand family. Ray was 17 when he graduated from high school, a time when a boy's life must necessarily take a turn, for either he goes to college then, or he never goes as a rule. Sometimes circumstances force the decision, but more often it depends upon the boy himself. When Ray graduated, he had less than $10 of his own, but he had had an abundance of clean, solid grit. Searching the papers for a summer job, he found an announcement by the chief forester of the Adirondack Mountain region that a man was wanted to watch the forest fires from the Knob Mountain lookout station. The salary was $100 a month and camp. It sounded good, and eventually Ray appeared in the chief forester's office. "What can I do for you?" the broad-shouldered, keen-eyed official asked. "I'm applying for the Knob Mountain job." "Know what it's like?" "No, sir, but I think I can watch for fires." "It's a man-sized job, son. The work isn't much, but it's the solitude that gets you unless you like it. I seldom get a man to stay the season through. It is 7 miles straight back in the woods. There are no camps near, and you are not allowed to leave your post day or night. There is a telephone, but you don't use it for pleasure since it runs into this office. Twice a month, we send a man up with supplies, and I drop in occasionally. You will probably see no other persons until you come out in the fall." "I like the woods," said Ray. "I shouldn't be lonesome." The chief looked doubtful. "Why not get a pal to go with you?" he suggested. "You can make a camping trip out of it and have considerable fun. Alternate the work and divide the wages." Ray shook his head. "I need all the money," he said. The chief's face became very thoughtful, for he had once been a boy and needed money himself. "What's the idea?" he asked kindly. Ray told him. The chief smiled. "Want to enter the service, sir?" "Well, that puts a different face in the matter. I guess, after all, there is no reason why you shouldn't have the job." Within a week, Ray was established on Knob Mountain with 2 weeks' provisions, a few books, a clock, a camera, and a light rifle of his own, besides the professional equipment provided by the service. His camp was the watchtower itself. It was a steel, round, and rose 20 feet above the rocks in the mountain peak. The ground floor was a tiny kitchen, the next a sleeping room, and the third and top the observation post. Such a view! On clear days, Ray could see through the binoculars hundreds and thousands of acres of land and water. Deep forest for the most part, except for occasional small valley clearings and lakes. And on the east, the long, glistening expanse of Lake Champlain. Well, the sun was just right. The spires of Montreal glistened 100 and more miles to the north. And at night, lights, none nearer than 7 miles, twinkled here and there below. Over this mighty track, it was Ray's duty to watch, and, should smoke appear, to locate it as best he could on his maps and telephone the news to the chief's office. There was plenty of rain that season, and he had but 2 small fires to report. The chief called up frequently, partly to keep in touch with the boy with whom he had taken a fancy, and partly in an attempt to catch him away from his post. But he never did. For though Ray longed to steal away for a ramble in the woods, he always kept within sound of the telephone bell, as he promised to do. A man came up with fresh supplies once a fortnight, and the chief dropped in unannounced 3 or 4 times. But aside from them, Ray saw no one except at the distance through the glasses. On a sleepy afternoon in August, the chief was on the wire. "I'm going to be away for a few days," he said, among the other things. "If anything happens, ask for Mr. Adams. He will be in charge here." "Yes, sir," said Ray. And after more talk, he asked as usual. "Any news?" "Oh, yes. The Lake Placid Bank was robbed last night of $100,000 in cash. The police think the thieves got away through Malone. That's all. Goodbye." Lake Placid, the famous summer resort. That was not very far away, about 15 miles through the woods to the southwest, but hidden from the Knob Tower by an interposing mountain. The robbery was of no consequence to Ray, but for some reason it was so much in his thoughts after that that at first he believed it to be a dream when he was awakened in the night by a light and opened his eyes to see 3 men in his room, one with a drawn revolver. "Get up," the man commanded, "and find us some grub." "Who are you?" Ray asked, knowing it was no dream. "Never mind that." Ray looked about quickly. "We've got your rifle," the man said. "No use making any fuss. Get up." Ray got up, dressed, and went downstairs between the 2 men. Without a word, he set out some provisions, and the men ate hungrily, one of them standing at guard at the door, and all of them casting frequent glances at 3 canvas packs on the floor. When they finished, dawn was breaking, and he could see their faces better. They were cruel, hard faces. "Climb," the leader said suddenly, pointing to the stairs with his revolver. "Go clean to the top and stay there, or I'll shoot you down like a hedgehog." And there was no doubt about what he meant. Ray went up the stairs obediently, for there was nothing else to do. He stood no show against 3 armed men. "He can't signal from there, can he?" asked one anxiously. "No," answered the other. "There's nothing there but the phone. I know these places." Ray went up through his bedroom to the observation post, and looking through the window, saw, as he expected to, the severed telephone wires dangling from the rock-propped pole 100 feet away. He went back to the head of the stairs. The 2 flights were in line, so that from where he stood, he could look directly down on the table on the ground floor. The men were dumping 3 canvas packs on the table, and those packs were full of money, gold, silver, but mostly banknotes, laying in great pile. The leader glanced up suddenly, saw Ray, and quick as a lightning snatched his gun and fired. The bullet missed the boy by a few inches, glanced from the steel roof over his head, and crashed through the window. Not a word was said, and none was necessary. Ray tumbled back out of range and sat down. He had seen enough, though, to tell him that those men were the bank robbers who, instead of going through Malone, had fled straight into the woods. While the police were searching everywhere for cars on the highways and railways, the bandits were counting their loot on the mountaintop. Only one person besides themselves knew this, and that one was cooped up in the top of a steel tower, helpless. There was no possible way of getting down, for the outside of the tower was smooth, and to jump the 20 feet to the rocks below meant a broken leg, if nothing more. There was nothing to do but wait, so he waited. If only someone would come along. He took up his post by the window, and about noon could scarcely believe his eyes when up the trail came a man who brought him his supplies. Regardless of the circumstances, Ray leaned far out as he dared and shouted wildly, "The men who robbed the Lake Placid Bank are downstairs. They will shoot. Run!" The man stopped in his tracks and then came on again. And out of the tower door calmly walked the leader to meet him. They were in league. Ray sank back in dismay. His last hope was gone. There was not one chance in 1,000 that another person would come that way. How long would the bandits stay in the tower? What would they do with him? They dare not leave him go. Would they kill him? They looked capable of it. Whatever they did, it would not be pleasant. Ray could hear them talking, and dropping flat on the floor, put his ear as near to the head of the stairs as he dared, and listened. The supply man was relating how the search was progressing, which was the very reason for which he had been planted in the village below. The fact that they were supposed to have gone west or north pleased the men immensely, and in louder and more confident tones, they began outlining their plans. At dark, they would go down into separate valleys, and the next day, passing as trampers, would go to the nearest railroad points and get away by train. The supply man would go back as usual, but would soon receive a telegram saying that his brother was dead in New York, after which, of course, he might be expected to depart hurriedly. And the boy, someone asked? They would tie him up and leave him, they decided. It might mean his death by starvation, but they couldn't help it. Ray shivered. After a while, the supply man left the others and came up the 2 flights of stairs. "Make out a list of things you want brought up the next time," he said. "I'm going down about 3 o'clock." He made no attempt to explain his friendship with the bandits. Ray wondered if the man thought him a fool enough to be unable to put the 2 and 2 together. At any rate, he decided to be as taciturn as the next one and merely agreed to have the list ready. The man went downstairs again, and shortly after, Ray heard the tower door shut and the key turn on the outside. Looking down from his window, he saw the supply man and 2 others spreading blankets and coats on the rocks in the shade on the tower. They were tired after their night's work, and they lay down heavily. Evidently, the leader preferred a softer couch, for Ray heard him coming up the 1st flight of stairs. Then the cot in the tiny bedroom creaked, and soon all was still below. The boy sat down to think and decided that rather than be tied in the tower and die by inches, perhaps he would jump to the rocks when the time came and take his chances, slim as they were. As he laid his plans, the only sound was the ticking of his alarm clock on the shelf beside him. It was a very small clock, which he had bought because it would be easily packed up in the mountain. Thicker, but not more than a diameter, than a watch. It had a modest tick for a clock, but when it was aroused, it would ring. Ray's thoughts turned idly to his clock, and of a sudden he had an idea. He pondered it for 2 minutes. Then, looking down again and making sure that the men outside the tower were asleep, he stole to the stairs and peered into his bedroom. The bandit leader was sleeping furiously. The boy went back for the clock and, holding it carefully in his hands, began descending the stairs very, very cautiously. His heart was in his throat, for he knew if the man awoke, he might be shot. He reached the floor, and not daring to pause, so precious was every fraction of a second, he crept past the cot on his tiptoes, and so on down to the ground floor. The 3 packs full of money were on the table. He had a great desire to open them, but he knew that the time was more precious than money, and went about his work. Moving silently as a ghost, he took down a good-sized tin can, partly full of dried hull corn, emptied 2/3 of the corn on the table, leveled off the remainder inside the can, and put on this corn an empty cocoa can. Taking a pencil and a leaf from his notebook, he wrote, "The 3 men who robbed the Placid Bank are in the Knob Tower with the money. They will leave at dark, separately for railroad stations. The man who brings me the supplies is in with them and will get away tonight if you don't nab him. Telephone wires are cut, and I am a prisoner in the tower. Ray Rand." This note he placed in the small can inside the larger one. Then, taking up the little clock, he wound it and set the alarm at 5:30. Smiling a little, he placed the clock under the note, put the cover on the cocoa can, and then proceeded to bury it completely in the corn from the table. He felt the weight of the large can in his hands, held it close to his ear, and in an attempt to detect the clock's ticking, then set it back on the shelf, confident that no one could guess that it contained anything but the article advertised on its outside. 3 minutes later, he was safely back upstairs. "Got that list ready?" the supply man called from the kitchen an hour later. Ray dropped it down to the man, who eyed it sharply to see if it contained any hidden messages. Finding none, he put it in his pocket. "I wish that you would take back that package of hulled corn and tell the merchant you got it and that I ordered popcorn," Ray said to him. "I ain't going to fuss with that," the man growled. "Take it along," the leader commanded. "It will make things look more natural." "Well, where is it?" Ray directed him to the shelf and held his breath while he took down the can and thrust it into his packed basket. But the man suspected nothing and soon started away. It was already dark in the valleys when the bandit chief ordered Ray to come down. As the boy stepped into the kitchen, he was seized and in 2 minutes was bound hand and foot and laid on the floor. "You're a gritty chap," the leader said, standing over him in the darkness. "I hate to leave you this way, but we must get away and don't want you telling what you know too soon. If things go right, I may be able to send you help in 2 or 3 days. I will leave a dish of water and some food on the floor, and perhaps you can get enough of it to keep you going."
2 or 3 days or a week to remain bound, with only a little food and water picked off the floor, dog fashion. He might never be found until it was too late. He wished then he had jumped to the rocks as he had planned. "We'll be moving," the bandit said to the others. "You know where to go from here." Silently, they picked up their precious packs and stepped out into the darkness. Then came the sound of many feet, blows, and a couple of shots, and presently a big voice boomed. "Got 'em tied up, boys? Anybody hurt? Good. Now where's Rand?"
"Here," shouted Rand. "Here."
2 electric torches flashed through the doorway. A man wearing a sheriff's badge entered and cut Ray's bonds. "There's your friends," he said, pointing outside where the robbers were nicely handcuffed and guarded by 12 men. "We got the other one down in the village. Found your note, you see. And say, that was a mighty bright idea, fixing the alarm clock as you did. It happened to be in the store when the fellow brought in that hulled corn. The clerk set it back on the shelf, and in a few minutes later, rippity-bang!" He couldn't think of what was up until he dug into the corn and found the little clock going like a cyclone. And there was the note under it. "Best thing I ever heard of. Say, I guess you'll come in for a fat slice of the reward." Ray did come in for his share of it. And later, after the chief had heard the story, he received a scholarship to a forestry school that is second to none. He is there now.
And now, let's hear about the little kitten that would not wash its face. One day, when John the chauffeur brought the big car into the garage, he heard a soft purring noise over in the corner. When he reached there, he saw 3 little baby kittens lying beside old Tabby. They were all gray like her mother. Their dream had come true. All John said when he saw the nice new family was, "Well, well, well, now he has some kittens to help catch mice." But he looked as proud as Tabby did. He called the 3 kittens Fluffy and Puffy and Huffy, and Tabby the mother cat. Fluffy was as soft and gray as a fleecy cloud. Puffy was as fat and round as a big ball of gray wool. But Huffy was a little spitfire who used to put his back up and hiss at John when he brought in the car. Tabby soon felt as weary as the old woman who lived in the shoe. She had so many troubles, she hadn't the vaguest idea what to do. The big garage house, which had once been a peaceful all day long, now echoed with noise from morning until night. Fluffy and Puffy and Huffy raced and tumbled all over the place and hid in the most unheard-of corners. Puffy soon stood at the head of the class in keeping clean. She never had one spot on her soft gray dress, and her eyes never had any sleep left in them in the morning. Old Mother Cat had said keeping clean lessons were the most important of all. But half the time Huffy played truant with the neighbor's dog, so he stood at the foot of every class. Mother Cat worried until she grew quite thin. She worried most because Huffy could not keep himself clean. When he had been a baby kitten, she had kept him beautifully clean. But when he grew older and had received his lessons in washing, she expected him to do as he had been taught.
but every day he just gave himself a lick and a promise and then ran off to play with the neighbor's dog. He would never wash his face. One morning when John the chauffeur came into the garage, he found Fluffy and Huffy and Puffy all sitting in the big car. They wanted to take a ride. He left Fluffy and Puffy right where they were because they looked so pretty, but he threw Huffy out because his face was all dirty. When John reached the house, the little girl who rode with him in the car every day put a pretty blue bow on both Fluffy and Puffy and took them with her for a long ride. But Huffy had to stand on the sidewalk like a tramp kitten and watch his sisters ride by in all their glory. The little girl grew very fond of Fluffy and Puffy. She brought them cream for breakfast instead of skim milk, and real chicken for dinner instead of bones. But although Huffy brushed close against her skirt and tried to purr, she drew herself away and said, "Get out of here, you dirty kitten," and Huffy had to go and eat out of the garbage cans. Poor old Mother Cat coaxed and coaxed Huffy to wash his face, but he was too lazy and he never wet his paws and rubbed his fur clean and smooth. One day, soon after this, John was washing the big car. He had a bucket of soap suds and a brush. Fluffy and Puffy sat on the front seat watching him, but Huffy had to sit on the floor of the garage. He grew very cross because he was not in the big car, too. He put his little back and spit at John. Then suddenly he had an idea. He leaped into the air, and when John was not looking, he tried to jump into the big car, but John was too quick for him. He caught him by the nape of the neck, and with all his might he threw him into the pail of soap suds. "There, you dirty kitten," he said. "Perhaps you'll look better after you take a bath." Fluffy and Puffy crawled to the edge of the front seat and looked to see what was happening. All they could see was the bucket shaking. After a while, the bucket fell on its side and the soap sud spilled over on the floor of the garage. Huffy had struggled so hard, he had upset the bucket, and when he did so, he was so afraid of a whipping that he ran out of the door as fast as he could. He ran on and on until he came to a beautiful parkway. Then he sat down on the cool green grass and started to wash the soap suds off. He licked all the places he could reach with his tongue. Then he lay down to sleep. But his eyes smarted, and the soap suds in them kept him from sleeping. Pretty soon he thought of the lessons his mother had given him, so he wet his paw and washed his face. He sat on the green grass for 2 long hours and washed and washed and washed until his paw was tired from rubbing so much. Then he took a long nap in the sun to rest himself. When he started home, on the way he looked into the clear blue water. He stood on the bank to look for fish. He happened to see himself in the water. Huffy was so surprised he nearly tumbled into the lake. He looked handsomer than Fluffy and Puffy put together. His fur was soft and glossy, and his eyes shone like bright and green. On the way home, he passed the neighbor's dog playing in the mud. The dog barked for him to stop and play, but Huffy walked right on. His mother scarcely knew him when he reached home. She smiled proudly when she found out it was actually her Huffy. When John the chauffeur saw him, he put him in the car behind Fluffy and Puffy and drove him around to the house. When the little girl saw him, she said, "What a pretty kitten. I'll get him a blue ribbon, too." Then they all took a long ride.
That was lots of fun, Linda. We thank you very much for telling us the story tonight. Well, boys and girls, it's time for us to say goodbye and time for us to get on back to our homes. All right, everybody, climb on to your stars. Close your eyes real tight and wish. Oh, come on, go on, wish. And we, away we go. The reader for tonight's program was Linda Swanson. The engineer was Quincy Carter. The selection for tonight was In the Knob Mountain Tower by Merritt P. Allen from the second St. Nicholas anthology published by Random House, and The Little Kitten That Would Not Wash Its Face by Edna Diehl, published by Samuel Gabriel and Sons and Company, New York. Storytime is produced by the Mike Club student radio organization at Mary Washington College in cooperation with this station and was tape recorded in advance at the College Radio Center. Your producer for tonight's Storytime was Quincy Carter. ¶¶
In the finale, we feel the tense excitement of the entire crew as Wildy's well explodes and brings in a gusher. And so the curtain closes on the final act of Wildcat. Again, this is Rita Piscopo, your hostess on assignment listening, saying good night and thank you for listening.